Hello and welcome to Science World. This past week, the European Space Agency's comet chaser, Rosetta, made history when it became the first spacecraft to rendezvous with and orbit a comet. The Ebola virus outbreak in West Africa continues its deadly rampage. Medical experts are now saying that perhaps one of the most important keys in stemming the tide of infections may be education. And if you had to pick between having either a good supply of drinking water or electricity, what would you choose? A recently published study revealed that we just might have to make that choice by 2040 unless steps are taken to avert a possible crisis that could jeopardize both water and energy supplies. We'll talk with two of the study's main authors. These stories and more are coming up for you on VOA Science, Health and Technology magazine, Science World. The European Space Agency's Rosetta spacecraft made history this past Wednesday as it became the first space probe to rendezvous and orbit a comet. Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
This is a proud moment for the Paris-based European Space Agency. After a 10-year, 6 billion kilometer chase, its Rosetta orbiter finally caught up with Comet 67P between the orbits of Jupiter and Mars. ESA images show the probe heading toward a massive rock spinning in the starry darkness. For recently retired mission manager Gerhard Schwiem, reached by phone from ESA's operations center in Germany, Rosetta's rendezvous on Wednesday is not only a first in space history, but a career milestone.
For me, it's a great day. I've been working on this cometary cornerstone, as it's in the agency called in the program, since 85. The span of my professional career, so it's quite great that I started with something that is now basically accomplished.
Or at least the first phase is accomplished, because the biggest challenge lies ahead. In November, Rosetta's team hopes to put the probe's lander on the comet, an extremely delicate and complex operation. The ultimate goal, to dig back in time, a sort of space archaeology, to the very origins of our solar system.
Comets are not only fascinating objects when we see a comet in the sky, when it's bright enough and we see the tail in the night sky, but comets for us are very, very important because they can contain the material that has been preserved like in a deep freeze since the planets and the sun formed 4.6 billion years ago.
With the probe now orbiting around 67P, Rosetta's scientists will begin mapping the comet's surface with a range of instruments. They'll be studying the composition of gas coming out as the comet draws closer to the sun. If it touches down successfully, the lander will analyze the material below the comet's surface, along with its swing from cold to hot as it rushes towards the sun. The Rosetta mission is officially expected to wrap up by the end of 2015, but Schwiem says the probe has saved a lot of energy. At one point, controllers put it into hibernation for 31 months.
So my prediction is stay tuned, and till mid of 2016, you will get a lot of new information about the comet, and then derive from this new insight in how our solar system formed.
The U.S. National Aeronautics and Space Administration, or NASA, also contributed experts and instruments to Europe's Rosetta mission. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The Ebola outbreak has already killed hundreds of thousands of people in West Africa and is becoming the worst outbreak of the disease ever. Experts say education just might be the key in stemming the deadly outbreak. And look, our correspondent in West Africa has more.
Good afternoon, my people.
Good afternoon.
We have come in your community this afternoon to tell you about the danger of Ebola.
More of this is what public health experts say may turn the tide against Ebola. Health worker Bunch Wia met with a community in Margibi County, Liberia. Two people have died of the disease here.
Ebola has no cure. Ebola has no cure. But what you can do is to prevent yourself. What you can do is to prevent yourself from the deadly disease. Please stop eating bush meat. Please start touching your friend. Please start shaking hands. These are ways people can catch the Ebola disease.
People have plenty of questions.
Sir, can I ask you? Yes, I want to know, they say Ebola don't have cure, but what happened when it takes
This man says if there's no cure, then what can doctors do for people at the hospital? What's the point of going there? It's a common area of confusion. Health workers continue to remind people that some patients are fighting off the disease with medical care. They emphasize that for containment to work, sick people must be isolated so they don't infect others, and that every person who had contact with an Ebola patient's bodily fluids must be monitored in case any of those people get sick. That's how you stop the chain of infection. But that isn't happening everywhere in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, the countries hit hardest by the Ebola outbreak. The virus spread quickly across those countries' borders starting earlier this year. People did not know what the disease was. Some infected people hid from authorities or ran away. Families continued to handle and bury the bodies of Ebola victims. And so the disease continued to spread. Stefan Doyen, the West Africa chief for Doctors Without Borders, says that communities continue to resist medical assistance and more education is needed. Doyen says in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and certain parts of Guinea, where we have trouble accessing certain villages, we know there are probably cases there, that people are dying and that the disease is spreading, but we can do nothing. He says we either don't know about the cases or the population won't let us in because they don't understand we are there to help. Liberia and Sierra Leone have deployed security forces to enforce containment measures and protect health workers amid growing hostility. It's illegal to knowingly harbor someone who has Ebola. Liberia is considering quarantining affected zones. Sierra Leone already has. But can the outbreak be stopped through such dramatic measures? Dr. Unnikrishnan, the head of Disaster Response and Prevention for Plan International.
These measures will have limitations. So this is where informing people, educating people, and encouraging them to come forward when they see symptoms is key. That's what will be finally be yielding results.
He says more international funds are needed for nearly every aspect of this response effort, especially education. Meanwhile, health workers continue going door to door. They're handing out leaflets and tying up signs with hand-drawn pictures of the various symptoms, and putting catchy songs on the radio, scrambling to get to people before Ebola does. Look at Guinea, look at Sierra Leone, from the Ebola and Kala. Y'all won't tell me you can't believe. And look, VOA News, Dakar.
As we heard earlier, ESA's Rosetta spacecraft finally met up with its target comet after more than a decade of space travel. Right now, both the comet and spacecraft are located about halfway between the orbits of two planets. For this week's Science World Quick Quiz, what are those two planets? A. Jupiter and Saturn. B. Jupiter and Mars. Or C. Saturn and Uranus. Think about it, and good luck. We'll give you the correct answer in a few minutes from now.
Listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
Several hundred thousand people in Toledo, Ohio, were recently told not to drink the water. The city's water supply from Lake Erie was polluted with a toxin linked to the overgrowth of algae. While the water in Toledo may again be safe to drink, this problem isn't going away anytime soon. Roseanne Skirbel has the story.
The toxic algal scum settled over the city's water intake pipes and turned the water pea green. Residents relied on handouts of bottled water.
We're happy to have this.
It was stressful at first, definitely worrying about, I have a couple dogs at home and four children, and I wanted to make sure we had enough water, brush our teeth, and be able to drink it.
Lake Erie supplies water to 11 million people in the American Midwest. Algal overload is common in waterways worldwide, caused by fertilizer runoff and poor sewage management. Excessive algae deplete oxygen in the water and kill fish, says Laura Johnson, a research scientist at the National Center for Water Quality at Heidelberg University in Tiffin, Ohio.
It also becomes a problem when the type of algae that are growing is a cyanobacteria that can produce toxins. And when that happens, then we have issues because then those toxins can be in places like our drinking water, or we can get in contact with it if we're trying to swim there.
It can damage the liver and nervous system. Global warming is making the problem worse, Johnson says. Changing weather patterns produce stronger and more intense winds and storms, which move more nutrients off the land. In Ohio, the algal season is a long one.
The bloom that's been happening most recently, I mean, it's just started. And that's part of the reason why it's so scary for Toledo right now, is because, you know, this is the very beginning of the season. Most of the bloom occurs usually and gets the largest in September and October.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration tracks the bloom from space, according to NOAA oceanographer Richard Stump.
So we can use the satellite data to actually find the bloom, estimate the concentration, which then we can't tell you if it's toxic, but we can tell you if it's there and how much there is.
This helps alert scientists and public officials to take action. Stump says to better manage the problem, NOAA is also gathering data on the phosphorus that drives the bloom.
It's only the spring phosphorus, so the phosphorus that goes in the springtime that creates a bloom in the summer. Knowing that means that you can now create a strategy for how do you modify fertilizing practices, how do you modify cultivating practices so that the phosphorus stays on the fields, and so it stays there and doesn't run into the rivers and then into the lake.
Laura Johnson agrees that the long-term goal must be to keep nutrients on the land.
The one thing that I want to really emphasize is the need for continued monitoring, both of the different practices that are going on to the ground, but also continued monitoring of water quality, so that if for some reason a practice is just not working as well as we think it should be, then we can change, you know, what we're doing and what we're recommending to farmers.
Advocates for clean water want stiffer controls and greater cash incentives to encourage farmers to adopt best agricultural practices. Farmers balk at tighter regulations and recently saw a reduction in federal funds to address the issue. As the debate continues, one thing is certain: the algal problem is not going away anytime soon. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Scientists are looking at traditional African medicine for possible treatments for Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease. The Salk Institute for Biological Studies is analyzing the leaves and bark of a tree that grows on an island nation off the coast of West Africa. Joe DiCapua reports.
On São Tomé Príncipe, traditional healers have used the Voa Conga Africana tree for hundreds of years. It's a small tree that produces yellow or white flowers that turn into berries and seeds. The seeds and bark have been used as a poison, aphrodisiac, and psychedelic. But traditional healers knew it somehow affected those believed to have brain disorders. Pamela Maher is a senior staff scientist at the Salk Institute's Cellular Neurobiology Lab.
We have developed over the years a variety of what are called phenotypic assays that mimic different aspects of what goes wrong in the aging brain. And we have thought for a number of years that plants that have been used in traditional medicines might offer a new source of potential therapeutic compounds for neurodegenerative diseases.
These include Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, as well as degeneration that occurs following a stroke. It's estimated as many as 5 million Americans are living with Alzheimer's, which causes a 500,000 deaths each year.
Right now, there really are no good treatments for any neurodegenerative disease. And so we thought that by combining our phenotypic assays that can screen for potentially therapeutic compounds with new potential sources of therapeutic compounds might be a wonderful combination.
Serendipity caused researchers to focus on the Voaconga Africa tree. While visiting his family in Portugal, Maher's associate, Antonio Carais, met Maria do Madureira, a researcher studying herbal medicine on São Tomé Príncipe for many years. They developed tests to find medicinal properties in plants.
We were focusing on plant extracts that were used in traditional medicine, either specifically for brain disorders or were known to have anti-inflammatory activity. And it's now known that a lot of neurological diseases, or almost all of them, involve some degree of inflammation.
The researchers found that the anti-inflammatory properties of the tree extracts were mostly due to one molecule called voicamine. No tests have been done on animals yet, but this is the molecule that potentially could lead to a synthetic drug for brain illnesses.
It was much more potent than we had expected something to be. So this showed that our approach for identifying these type of compounds works.
Maher says there are many potential sources of drugs in native plants around the world. Most of them have never been tested. She says since you cannot test every plant, the best approach is to use the knowledge that's been around for thousands of years to help pick and choose what to study. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
It's time to find out if you have the correct answer to this week's Science World Quick Quiz. ESA's Rosetta space probe, along with its target comet, are now both located about halfway between the orbits of two planets. For this week's Science World Quick Quiz, what are those two planets? A. Jupiter and Saturn. B. Jupiter and Mars. Or C. Saturn and Uranus. The answer is B. Rosetta and Comet Churyumov-Gerasimenko now lie about 405 million kilometers from Earth, about halfway between the orbits of Jupiter and Mars, and are zooming toward the inner solar system at nearly 55,000 kilometers per hour. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
Investigators in Denmark and the U.S. recently released two reports which revealed that unless preventative steps are soon taken, by the year 2040 there will not be enough water in most of the world to both quench our collective thirst and keep the current levels of electricity production. It turns out what consumes the most water in many parts of the world is the production of electricity. Many of us, according to the study, could very well someday be faced with some really difficult choices, having a good and plentiful supply of drinking water or feed our growing need for electricity. Professor Benjamin Sovacool from Denmark's Aarhus University and Paul Faith of the CNA Corporation, a nonprofit research organization, are two of the paper's key authors. They both join us for today's one-on-one segment to talk about their research and findings, as well as what they think it would take to avert a possible water or energy crisis in the future.
The way in which we use electricity right now is very water-intensive. And all four of the case studies we looked at in the report have issues by 2030 or 2040 of what's called water stress or water scarcity. And because of that, it's become somewhat challenging to meet electricity needs if the electricity sector will remain so thirsty. And so if business as usual continues, there's certainly some challenges. I don't think that we ever say anywhere in the report that somehow the world will be without water. It's more that people there will have to make tough choices about which electricity options to push given impending water issues. And that's precisely where Paul's work comes in, because his model helps policymakers determine what is the optimal mix for each of these regions. Is it nuclear? Is it gas? Is it renewables, etc.?
Paul, let me ask you, when we're using water to cool for electricity, are we dealing primarily with the atomic power?
No, although atomic power is the thirstiest of all the various choices. there isn't a smokestack, which is one of the key things, and then they can't operate at high efficiencies for safety reasons. But nuclear is the thirstiest. Coal is next. Natural gas is about half, uses about half the water of coal. And then wind, photovoltaics, and energy efficiency, of course, don't use any water. So that's where the advantages come in and where we find some synergies in the report.
I understand there were four studies being made. China was studied, India, as well as Texas and France. Did you see any similarities or any differences between these very diverse areas?
Choosing case studies is always challenging because there are so many that you can pick. And what we wanted to do is we wanted to pick at least some that were geographically diverse, hence North America, Europe, Asia. And then within that, each of the four case studies have very different kind of electricity structures, markets, and needs. And so France, for most people who already know, is very nuclear power dependent. They lead the world with the most percentage of electricity from nuclear power. China, the North China grid, is very coal dependent. And so they're even planning to add more coal-fired capacity now, despite climate change and all this talk about stranded assets. India is one of the fastest growing populations, and by the next decade they're expected to overtake China as the most populated country on the planet, yet it's a very dry subcontinent. And so they're also planning to use a lot of coal, but face more serious, I suppose, constraints than the Chinese. And then Texas is also an area that has been prone to drought, but they're one of the fastest places in the world to adopt wind electricity. So by choosing these four different places, we kind of got to look at different mixes in terms of renewables, fossil fuels, as well as demographic criteria.
If we were to select between having electricity or having a good supply of drinking water, of all the forms of power that are available right now, what is the one that would use the least amount of water?
Well, what we recommend in the report, to follow on and answer that question, the first thing, energy efficiency, which there is a lot of potential for, energy efficiency requires no new capacity at all. So it's the cheapest thing to do, and it requires no water, you know, has no conventional pollutants like sulfur dioxide and particulates, but also releases no greenhouse gas emissions. And secondly, wind and photovoltaics, similarly, they don't require any water. Photovoltaics, only a small amount just to wash the panels. And again, you know, they require no water, but they don't have any conventional pollutants. The next thing, where it's available, and it is not available everywhere, but switching from coal to natural gas can cut water use by half to 40% in terms of what's required for the power sector. So where those are, those options are available, which includes Texas and in or all of them, energy efficiency is possible. All of them, wind and photovoltaics, are possible. And gas is only possible, really, in Texas and in China. But so there are options that are, we find, that are cost-effective that will reduce the amount of water consumed in the power sector and thus avoiding competition with other sectors and uses in the economy.
Can this potential crisis be averted?
Yeah, I think so. And what's interesting, the Texas example, the case actually points to ways forward. You know, what we recommend in the report is, you know, greater use of energy efficiency, greater use of renewables, moving away from coal to the extent that you can. All of those point the way forward. And other things we don't really get into, but using water more efficiently, more generally in the broader economies would also be something to pursue.
And I just wanted to add that I also am hopeful that we can address this crisis, and it's precisely those reasons. It's that the things that you should be doing to lessen the water intensity of electricity are the same things that you should be doing to cut carbon, to cut pollution, to promote more jobs, et cetera. And so it's kind of yet another reason to back efficiency, renewables, and possibly natural gas strategic ways, and that gives huge co-benefits. Not only do you start to save water, but you start to promote diversification, energy security, local employment, on and on and on and on, cleaner air, et cetera. And so I think because of those co-benefits, this is definitely a crisis that we can avert because the solution has so much to give.
That was Professor Benjamin Sovacool from Denmark's Aarhus University in Aarhus, Denmark, and Paul Faith of the CNA Corporation in Arlington, Virginia. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.